Welcome to Skillful Means Podcast. I'm Annie Moyer.
And I'm Jennifer O'Sullivan. Before we jump into today's topic, we have some housekeeping things to share. We've got summer coming up, and I don't know about you, Annie, but this is feeling like the first real summer we've had since 2020. And I'm hearing from a lot of people that ambitious travel is on the menu. What are you up to?
I am hearing the same thing. For me, ambition has no place in travel. That stresses me out more than anything. So my ambitious travel is to go sit seaside in Cape Cod for 2 weeks.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I fantasize about, like, I wouldn't want to do a cruise, but I totally get the logic of a cruise and the vibe of a cruise, and that everything's planned and you just kind of show up and there's no way to go anywhere.
Right. As you're going somewhere.
Yeah. It seems on paper like a perfect thing, but I don't think I could do an actual cruise, but I like the concept. So to accommodate our own travel plans this summer, Annie and I are taking a break from our monthly conversations in July, August, and September. We'll be back in October, but we're not going to leave you hanging. Through these months, we're going to be releasing bi-weekly guided practices so you have support whether you're on the go or staycationing.
And that's the beauty about simplicity when it comes to vacation time, because it makes space for practice that doesn't feel rushed, that doesn't feel pressurized. It's a really great opportunity to take the time to do practices that otherwise just feel too maybe cumbersome.
Yeah, and I think I'm almost done recording, but the ones I'm going to be releasing are all meditations. So even, you know, no equipment, nothing. It's just a little quiet place where you can steal away from the hubbub, if there is hubbub for you. So speaking of not having equipment and stuff with you to do practice, today we're talking about what yoga practice without postures looks and feels like. And I think most of us in the West, though definitely not the folks listening to this show, may have the impression that yoga is the asanas or is the postures. And maybe you couldn't imagine a yoga class that isn't focused on asana. But that's definitely not the way yoga is universally practiced, especially in India, where, of course, yoga originated.
Definitely not exclusive to posture practice, for sure. And it's a funny thing to hear maybe from a yoga studio owner, because why would anybody come to a yoga studio if not to practice posture? But, and I'll tell you why in my point of view. And it is precisely because the postures are not the postures unto themselves. We don't do a yoga pose for the sake of doing a yoga pose. We do a yoga pose for the sake of everything else that it brings to light in our present moment awareness and circumstance and perspective. It opens our eyes to things in ways that other forms of quote-unquote exercise or other activities may not necessarily do. What are your thoughts, Jen?
What I enjoy is noticing not only how I feel in my body and getting embodied, but also using that time to get curious about the ways in which I talk to myself while I'm doing this activity. You know, how do I get myself in trouble? Let me notice the tendency to want to fix something about myself or wish I could do something that I can't do anymore or as good as the person next to me. It's a real interesting window into how the mind responds to things in this nice, controlled environment where the stakes are really low. Because chances are, I'm doing that same kind of thing out in daily life interactions and that kind of thing. So I think it's really a nice opportunity to not only get in the body, but also inquire, what's the state of my mind? What's my conditioned response to things? And what have I been believing this whole time that may or may not hold up to scrutiny? So that kind of stuff too.
Yeah. And I know too that there are times in life when physical practice just isn't possible, or at least it's highly inconvenient, or for whatever reason, unattainable. Do you have any personal experiences with that, Jen?
Well, not exactly that, in the sense that I couldn't practice asana, so I had to do something else. But the thing that came to mind as I was preparing for this podcast is that, and I might have a long time ago talked about this part of my childhood story, is that when I was living in Alabama, which we lived at until I was about 12 years old, our neighbors were a family of immigrants from India. Mm. And we were very close with them. Both of my parents were shift workers, and every now and then they would be gone at the same time. So I would stay over at the Pitnikes' house. And so they were like my second family. Loved them, felt very included. I was taught some of their language, which I think was Hindi, but I'm not totally sure because I didn't know to ask when I was 9 years old. I just took the words. But, you know, I was calling people uncle and auntie, even though they weren't my uncle and my auntie and stuff like that. And I would spend the night over at my friend's house sometimes, as I said. And my friend would get up in the morning and she's like, do whatever you want, but I got to go do this yoga. And sometimes I would sit there and watch with her and observe. And it involved, her yoga practice involved lighting incense, which was super exotic to myself in, like, I don't know, 1982 Alabama. I was like, what are you doing? And then I remember she'd ring a bell, and because she had this altar, not an elaborate thing. It was, you know, a personal altar. She would do some praying, some chanting. Probably she did some breath work, but that's a little fuzzy. But mostly I remember her sitting quietly.
Yeah.
And just kind of being like, what's going on? Yeah, I was full of ADHD and, you know, seven and restless. But it was, I observed that every time I stayed at their house. And so for a very long time, when I was older and I heard about people going to yoga and I hadn't gone to yoga, as we would say now. In particular, I had this college roommate who was really into yoga. And I remember thinking it was weird because I was like, but that's like a religious thing. It was really associated to me with a religious practice that my friend and her family were doing.
Wow.
And so I was kind of confused for a while as to what this white person friend of mine was doing when she said she was doing yoga. And then not long after is when you started to see those displays at the bookstore with the Rodney Yee DVDs from Gaim and or VHS tapes, you know, and you could get your yoga mat block and VHS tape bundle and start your home practice, right? And so then I was like, I don't remember my friend doing that. What's going on? So
you had the opposite experience of so many, late 20th century Americans.
Yeah. And, you know, it caught up and I probably am interrogating it more now than I did at the time. But I just remember being like, Why are you doing yoga? I don't understand. Just thinking it weird that a white person would be like adopting somebody else's religious practice.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think I was nevertheless drawn to practicing yoga, however it became in the studio setting because of my experience with that family and being at their house for other functions and going to see my friend do her dance performances and stuff like that, that it was just a way to harken back to that part of my life. How about you?
Well, a couple things come to mind. The first one was when you were talking about like being a young child and being exposed to yoga in the way that you were, which is so beautiful. My experience was the opposite, but not in sort of a commercialized studio way, because it was the 70s. I was little. And my mother grew up in Brookline, Massachusetts. And so my grandmother in the 50s and 60s and then early 70s when I came along was immersed in what was called then physical culture, and especially for the young housewives who were expected to keep their bodies looking a certain way for their husbands. And I'm saying all of this with my tongue deeply in my cheek and my eyebrows way up on the ceiling, but that's how it was. And that's the culture that my mother grew up in. And so I would see my grandmother practicing postures and then my mother following along after that. But
Annie,
somehow,
sorry to interrupt, but I can't.
No, go ahead.
Like jumping out of my seat.
Yeah.
Have you watched Miss Maisel?
Mrs.
Maisel?
Yes, of course.
I think it was
exactly.
In the first season, they show them at their exercise class.
The exercise class. Yes. That was my grandmother. And then that was my mother. Yep.
Okay.
I don't know that they were like measuring their waists necessarily, but yeah, that's what it was. And so even with all of that being the backdrop of my, you know, my yoga background, somehow I knew that there was more to it. And I've told this story a million times, but and probably here in other episodes of the podcast, but the first time I actually was formally taught yoga posture by my friend Bobby Ponce Barger in her apartment in Adams Morgan in the early 90s. And she had us come into child's pose and I burst into tears. And I thought, yeah, I had a feeling there was more to this than just the body. And I asked her about it after class and she said, oh, you should read the Bhagavad Gita. So here we are.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thankfully, we're not wearing leotards anymore.
Right.
So these are some interesting stories. Child's pose. It's a pose, but it's not like, you know, a highly choreographed postural experience, right? Kirtan at an altar or chanting mantra. Not what we think of when we go to class. And this isn't just anecdotal stuff. We do have texts and teachings and practices. And of course, famously, there's only like one mention of asana in all of the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. So I thought maybe we could jump into other practices that are part of this larger practice of yoga that is not asana at all. And you mentioned the Gita, so I wonder if we could start there. What does the Gita say about what yoga is?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the Gita says there are four kinds of yoga for four different temperaments. And depending on who you are and what your dharma is, what your purpose and duty in the world is, that's where you might land as a practitioner of yoga. And the very first one that it addresses is the karma of yoga, the yoga of action. And this is where our protagonist in the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna, is finding himself at a crossroads and having a breakdown over having to go and fulfill his duty as a warrior. And his teacher, Krishna, is instructing him that he must. And his yoga is the yoga of karma in this regard. He must act. He must stand up, shake off his doubts, shake off his fears, shake off his apprehensions and confusion, and take a stand. And in addition, as the text goes on and as the conversation ensues between Arjuna and Krishna, we understand that in addition to the yoga of karma, there is the yoga of wisdom, jnana, the yoga that says there are things to learn about our existence that will help us take action, that will help propel us forward in our dharma, in our duty, in our life's purpose. And that wisdom has everything to do with understanding who we are. And from this standpoint, from this particular philosophy, which is different than the Buddhist philosophy and different from many Western philosophies, in this understanding of existence, who we are is not limited to the body, not limited to our thoughts and feelings, not limited to the energy that enlivens us, and that those things are not separate from an enduring, continuous, and divine notion of capital S self that is the abiding presence of consciousness. And that is a practice of yoga, to become wise to this knowledge. So there's two.
Can we pause there and just take a moment to ask the question? I think being true to who you are, you know, the first piece of what you said, do your duty, be the warrior if that's your job. Show up as you are. Don't try to be a pretender of something that you're not. I think that makes a lot of sense. I think we can sort of take that in. I think it's probably harder to put that into practice, but nevertheless. But this bit about developing wisdom, where do we do that?
I think this is
where some people maybe get hung up. It's like, oh yeah, I've heard about this, but how do I actually do that? You know what I mean?
I love that question. Yeah. That's such a good question. I mean, number one, I don't know. But number two, I have some ideas. I have some really, really clear ideas based on experience, my own and the experiences of people around me. Where do we do that? Well, we can do it on the yoga mat. There's nothing wrong with that. That's a lovely place to start. We can do it wandering through nature. We can do it in the library, consuming books, if anyone consumes books in the library anymore, wherever you and however you consume books, you know, so delving into the written knowledge that's been handed down through the ages, we can do this in the place of worship of our choice, right? Because these teachings are not inconsistent with religious practices or traditions or trainings.
Right.
We can do this with each other in relationship, in the ways that we attend to the needs and the tendernesses of the people closest to us in our lives. Those are just some places that I would start.
You know what strikes me as you were listing all the things, what kind of the underlying thread with all of them is a conscious choice to stay open-minded and willing to not be fixed on your own view of things. Because otherwise, what is reading for? What is contemplating? What is showing up for other people really about if we're not open to those experiences unfolding in the way that they're going to and what we might even learn from that? So it's a maturation process, but I think we see in culture that not everybody matures. That was sort of the biggest shock of my adult life is realizing that not everybody's growing up.
Yeah.
And I felt so gypped in a way, but I think it comes down to a willingness to stay open and not always be right and subject to changing your mind. And maybe that's part of the sort of necessary ingredients for developing wisdom.
You know, it's reminding me there is a verse in the Gita, which I can't quote chapter and verse off the top of my head, but we'll put it in the show notes after I find it, where Krishna says to Arjuna, don't just do this thing for the sake of doing this thing. He says the people who, it's something along the lines of the way it's translated is like, there's the letter of the law and there's the spirit of the law. Do it in the spirit of the law. There's also the verse that I am quoting, chapter 3, verse 25, the ignorant work for their own profit, the wise work for the welfare of the world without thought for themselves.
I love that, that Krishna, the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law. The Buddha said many things to that same effect as well, particularly about, you know, not holding in a fixated way to views and teachings and practices, that it's, you know, everything is situational, circumstantial, and changes and evolves in the way that everything changes and evolves.
Yeah.
I love that. What's the third one?
So the third one is the yoga of devotion, bhakti. You mentioned your friends, your neighbors and friends chanting. That is yoga. We have the tradition of kirtan, which is chanting to the divine, to the many aspects of the divine in this tradition. And in the Bhagavad Gita, a critical part of Arjuna's understanding in this pivotal moment of his life is to know that he's not just doing this work for the glory of winning the war on behalf of his fellow fighters, but that he's doing it as a devotion to Krishna, to the essence of a divine, benevolent, conscious energy in the universe. And Krishna says to Arjuna, whatever you do, do it for the sake of me. Never forget that it is me in your heart, is me all around you. It's all for me. And the me is not the me that we would consider to be an egoic me, not a selfish me, not a I'm so great as a person me, but the me that represents the teacher in all of us, the guide in all of us, the awakened spirit of presence and the all-pervasive power of universal consciousness, if that's something that we believe we can tap into.
What I'm hearing when you talk about me as not being like I, me,
yeah,
the I-ness of it, is the orientation around community when you engage with devotional practices, because they often take place in houses of worship, right? Growing up, I didn't like going to church like a lot of people. I found it boring as a kid. A lot of the whatever was being discussed or lectured about was way over my head. But I loved the singing. And as soon as that happened, I would hop up with my hymnal. And we weren't in a very religious family, but it was a Christian church. And I would just love the singing. And thinking back to that same family, my neighbors, we didn't have a Hindu temple in my little town in Alabama. So the Indian families in that community would take turns hosting their prayers and their communal worship sessions. I don't know what they were called. At each other's houses. And so sometimes when it would come around to my friend's house, I'd go over and hang out. And quite a lot of it was kirtan. And it was so fun. I just remember they would teach me the words. They're simple to learn and join in. And that same sense of here we are co-creating this magic through words and music and the feeling of community that comes through that, that it's you can't sing in a group or chant in a group without feeling that oneness with one another. It's so beautiful. And I love that part of yoga.
I agree wholeheartedly. In chapter 2 of Annie Crying, I'll share that in my Jewish life, whenever I do go to temple and we sing the Shema, which is, I'll spare you here an actual tune, but the words are Shema Israel. And it means hear me. It means God, hear me. And it is 100% devotional, and it makes me cry every single time. And it's funny because I really love to belt it out, but my voice cracks because I'm crying every time.
Yeah, you get that tight throat feeling, and
it's quite
it's like stuck and coming out too fast at the same time.
And I think that's I don't know what the physiology of all of it is and the emotional tie to how the body responds, but I think that this yoga of devotion that we're talking about, I think it's because a devotional quality is so powerful. It takes us out of our kind of mundane experience of being us. It takes us to a higher place.
Yeah. For me, it's fellowship. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking too about, you don't really associate Buddhism with singing and chanting. Chanting, yes, there's chanting. But if you go on a retreat with the Plum Village monastics, they divide you up into what they call Dharma families. And that's kind of your home-based group that you check back in with a couple times a day. How's your practice going? Anything that needs to be attended to can be brought to that circle. And there's a monk or a nun, sometimes a couple of them, attending to each group. And then, and you're also doing your working meditation with that group as well. And so you start to get to know them and you kind of connect with them on a personal level. But on the last day of usually a 5-day retreat, there's like a whole evening of skits and performances.
I did not expect that.
And so you're meant to, like, with that Dharma family group, come up with something to contribute to the talent show.
Well, now we're talking fun.
Yeah. And there actually are some songs, the Plum Village community. There's a lot of music. A lot of people play instruments. And so there's a songbook and stuff like that. So sometimes people will do little spoofs on the songs from the songbook, or the kids, when the kids do their things, so cute always. So again, like, In many ways, that's fellowship practice, right? It's doing something in community to this sort of shared common ground. Like, we may not agree on a lot of things, but here we are together with these core beliefs and values. And to me, that speaks to bhakti as well, just coming together in fellowship to express our spiritual beliefs in that way. So, what's the fourth one?
Well, the fourth one is really the closest one to what we conceive of as being quote unquote yoga. And it's raga. It's the yoga of meditation, which in some respects incorporates the yoga of posture. It subsumes it because it's said to be the postural practice is said to be the preparation of the body in order to be able to sit for meditation. And then in other treatments of it, it's separated into a fifth type, hatha alone as a fifth type. Okay. But one way or the other, I think we might be able to really easily recognize that yoga is a meditative pursuit. And whether we're sitting still or whether we're up on our feet or upside down on our head or on our backs, et cetera, on our belly, that we are priming the seat. And most people who've been in the yoga world any amount of time have heard the term asana as meaning pose, and hopefully have heard also that the translation from Sanskrit means seat.
Yeah, so it's much more about your sitting posture and being comfortable and long standing in many ways so that you can do this deeper level of meditation without suffering.
Yeah, and if you want to extrapolate from that and use the term, I guess almost metaphorically, you can say that we're practicing how to sit skillfully in the world, wherever we're sitting.
I like that frame. Sitting or being in a seat as a stand-in for how we show up.
Right, right.
How connected am I to myself? How self-aware am I? Mm-hmm. Not just physically, but verbally. How well am I listening? How well am I receiving?
Yeah.
Open versus closed. Yeah, it's an interesting frame.
And then how skillfully am I acting?
Yeah. Yeah.
So my story about doing yoga when I couldn't do posture was that I literally couldn't do posture because I was pregnant with twins on bed rest for 3 months.
Three?
3 months. Two of those months in the hospital.
Oh my gosh. Sorry. That just seems like hell.
I will be very honest with you, Jen. It was one of the best 3 months of my life.
Wow.
I have never been so deeply rested, so well cared for, so at ease, because I didn't have to do anything. And I am a person who doesn't really like to do things. Okay, my dream come true is to sit with a cup of tea and a book. So that's what I did for 3 months. And okay, I'm probably exaggerating because there was a reason I was on bed rest. You know, my pregnancy was at risk. So there was that. There was a little bit of stress involved. And also I had immense privilege to be in a job where I wasn't working because I was a school teacher and it was summertime. So I didn't have to worry about missing work and I was being paid. I had good health insurance. We had the best of medical care. My husband was employed and able to care for me. So, you know, all of those things I don't take for granted. And I don't say lightly that it was the best time of my life, but all of those things in place with all of the gratitude that they beckon. It really was a terrific time. And having already had a well-established yoga practice and my teacher, who was also a dear friend who came to see me weekly, she talked me through pranayama and we meditated together. And that was my practice that whole time. And that's what got me through.
I love it because we have on our list things you can do besides asana.
Yep.
Pranayama.
Yep.
Meditation.
Yep.
I'm thinking about Annie in the bed. Mm-hmm. Yoga Nidra.
Right.
Fantastic practice.
And visualization. You know, I was visualizing that these babies would come into the world full and healthy.
Yeah.
And they did. that was a huge piece of it.
I guess there's some chakra visualizations that I've come across in yoga class, but if you're into visualization or think you might be, that's when you want to explore the Chinese yogis, the Taoists. They have a lot to offer in terms of visualizations, and they're super into the chakras as well. So you get all of that. But there are many, many practices that center around visualizing qi flow, visualizing vortexes of energy, robust and bright, and even directing colors to different organs to amplify the body's self-healing qualities. And so there's a lot there if that is a space that you'd like to add to your practice. I've enjoyed that myself. We did talk about reading and contemplation of texts, Dharma books, and listening to Dharma podcasts and all kinds of things to receive teachings is definitely a practice of yoga. So all those books that we read that seem a little bit self-helpy and indulgent, it counts. It counts.
Absolutely. Here's a funny story about this is sort of the headline of the story is the joke's on me, because I have been preaching this truth forever that yoga is not just poses. And as you know, I'm in this Master of Divinity program focused on Buddhist chaplaincy and studying at Naropa University. And one of the things we had to learn last semester was the four Indian philosophical schools of Buddhism. And one of them is referred to as the mind-only school. But another way of referring to it is Yogacara, right? So I raised my hand out loud to the whole group, said, well, isn't that ironic that Yogacara is mind only? And by now, everybody knows each other well, and they know what my background is. And the professor, like, gave it a beat and smiled, and he said, well, Annie, I'm pretty sure you know that yoga's about more than just the body, that ultimately it's a mind practice. And I thought, yeah, there you go. That's how deep social conditioning is.
Yeah, we have to interrogate what we think we understand about stuff.
Yeah.
It's a continual practice. So as we look ahead to summer, I thought, Annie, we might share our summer reading recommendations. And this is purely selfish because I'm between books right now and I'm looking for something to read on the airplane. I thought we could do one Dharma selection and then one novel, fiction, whatever, beach read, right?
Awesome.
So starting with Dharma book, what's your Dharma book recommendation?
My Dharma book recommendation is called Contemplating Reality, and it's by Andy Carr. The subtitle is A Practitioner's Guide to the View in Indo-Tibetan Buddhism. It's a little bit scholastic, but it's actually one of the best sort of condensations of this very complicated body of wisdom and tradition that we call Buddhism. And it's focused on the way Tibetan Buddhism has evolved, and it includes a sort of an exposition of these four Indian philosophical traditions in very plain language and very accessible frame. So I'm really enjoying this as sort of a way to help me understand a lot of new and complex material. It's inspiring.
I haven't heard that one.
Yeah.
I'll check that out. Thank you.
How about you?
So my Dharma read, I'm going to stick with the yoga beyond asana theme, and I'm going to recommend an oldie but a goodie, If you haven't already read it, or even if you have, maybe it's time for a reread. I highly recommend Matthew Sanford's memoir / Dharma book called Waking.
Oh my goodness. Yes.
Yeah. So in it, Matthew chronicles his life after a car accident left him paralyzed from the chest down and confined to a wheelchair. Yeah. And I think it was a little bit later in life, maybe in his 20s, he encountered yoga, Iyengar yoga in particular, which really opened up a whole new lease on life for him. And his contemplations on prana in that book are just divine, so exquisite. And I also recommend the podcast that came out around the time that he was promoting the book with Krista Tippett. I don't remember what her podcast is called.
On Being.
Is that what it's called now, or was that what it used to be called?
I think it's always been called that.
No, they changed it at some point.
Oh. No. Okay. Well.
It got a new name, and I don't know. I'll look it up and I'll put it in the show notes.
Okay.
I'll go find and I'll link to the podcast. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous interview with Krista Tippett on particularly around the spiritual practice of yoga and prana. So that's my Dharma read. How about your beach read?
Well, here's the thing, Jen, and people don't at me, but my beach reads come in the form of TV binging. So that's what I do for pure pleasure. So when I do sit with a book in hand, I like to challenge myself a little bit. And I've been in a book club forever and ever and ever, and we chose to read Barbara Kingsolver's newest novel, Demon Copperhead. But we learned when the book came out that Demon Copperhead is actually a reimagining of Charles Dickens' David Copperfield. Oh. Isn't that clever? And Barbara Kingsolver has it taking place in modern day rural America, and it's about poverty and the opioid addiction problem that's been so devastating. And as we know, Dickens is all about poverty and the plagues of underserved communities, which sounds funny to say that about you know, the 1700s and or 1800s in England, but there it is. So I am rereading David Copperfield, and I have to say it is pure delight because this character is so guileless. He has no ill view of anybody. And of course, it doesn't serve him well in the end. But my goodness, it's refreshing to love somebody who's so innocent and kind and only sees the good.
Like our friend Ted Lasso.
Yes, exactly.
We were catching up after my husband was out of town, and I was just like, oh, I love this show so much. It's so heartwarming.
Yeah.
We need more of that. We really do. We're so into our biting commentary and our sharp critiques and our investigative inquiry, and sometimes it really is nice to just follow a kind heart through the world.
Especially after watching Succession.
I didn't watch that one. So
tell me what your beach read is.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to cheat a little bit because maybe some people have picked up on this for me. I don't like to read singletons.
Oh, you're a series girly.
And I like my books really long.
Yeah.
And this is because I don't like that in between book time. It's really uncomfortable. I get really anxious and upset in a way. Like, I feel really incomplete being in between books. And I find it stressful looking for new things to read. Mm-hmm. So if I can get a good series in and just kind of hang out there for months, love it.
Yeah.
This one will not last for months, though. If you haven't read it yet, or you did, and it's been a while, is the Silo series by Hugh Howey. And you know I like my sci-fi. Yeah. So it's in that vein. First book in the series is called Wool, and it delves into the lives of the people who have been relegated to living in an underground silo because of some catastrophe that has rendered the surface of Earth unlivable.
Oh boy.
No, right? They've been there so long, they don't know any longer what happened at the surface. And it's questionable if they were even told, like if that was withheld from them. And they're starting to get a little stir crazy after being down there for 100+ years. and it presents an interesting treatise on kind of the debate between individualism versus the community good, alongside what happens when our beliefs, you know, the beliefs that we all share to kind of lubricate our lives socially start to.
You mean the lies we tell each other and ourselves? Yeah. The mythologies that we think are real.
Yeah. And when that starts to break down.
Yeah.
And not keep things moving more smoothly. My husband and I read this series when it came out back in the day. He very famously self-published at a time when people weren't really doing that. And it took off, and then he got picked up by a big publishing house. But we've been waiting for it to be made into a show for a long, 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 long time. And Apple finally did it. And you can watch the Silo series on Apple TV Plus now. So it's so far, they're pretty faithful. I don't like to often read books and watch the show too close together because I get like, I don't get mad, but I just can't stop that part of me that's like, that wasn't in the book. Oh, they changed it.
Right.
Like, it's just this kind of dialogue. But it's actually been so far really good. And Rebecca Ferguson is great. And so it's a good, fun, not 100% super light reading, but it's not doom and gloom like it kind of sounds like. So there you go.
Cool.
Well, we're going to be back with you in October. Chatting away about something.
Yes.
If you have any requests, do email us.
Indeed. Have a wonderful summer if you're listening to this in the spring. and we hope you enjoy some of our guided practices and meditations. Thank you so much for listening. And be in touch. Email us feedback@skillfulmeanspodcast.com. Or leave us a voicemail at speakpipe.com/skillfulmeanspodcast. We don't do this just for each other. We do it for you. And so any sort of interaction is really wonderful to have.
Yeah. Indeed. And if you do like the show, make sure you subscribe so you get our episodes as soon as they appear. Love a good share. If you know somebody who would like the topics we cover, or maybe there's some particular episode, there's a little share button somewhere in your app. I know it. Rate, review, all those things. We do appreciate that because it does help us to bubble up to the surface of all of the different options out there. And until next time, may we take refuge in the practices that help us move with ease, connect with grace, and be of service.